This afternoon I'll discuss an application of superrigidity and descriptive set theory to a classical problem in algebra, namely the classification problem for the torsion-free abelian groups of finite rank. So I'll begin by defining them and then say something of the history of this problem. Okay, so it's a very concrete class of groups. Up to natural isomorphisms, the torsion-free abelian groups of rank n, they're just the additive subgroups of an n-dimensional vector space over the rationals, which happen to contain a basis. And the classification problem simply asks you to explicitly classify these, maybe find very simple complete invariants which describe them up to isomorphism. The main points of the history of this subject can be quickly sort of summarized. In 1937, Baer classified the rank 1 groups. So these are just the subgroups of the additive group of the rationals. Then a couple of years later, Maltsev and Kurosh independently failed to classify the groups of higher rank. And then since then, a number of other people have duplicated their results. And it even seems to be a sort of rite of passage which group theorists go through. When they're young, they fail to classify the rank 2 groups. And this sort of leads to the question, why are all of these good mathematicians failing on this really simple problem? Is it because rank 2 and higher are genuinely harder, or just because they lack talent? Now, in this, you can't measure this difference in difficulty simply by looking at the number of groups, because there's already continual many rank 1 groups. So if you were to measure the difference in difficulty between these problems, you'd have to do something more sensitive. So following Friedman and Stanley, and then later Horth and Kekris, we're going to use Borel reducibility to study the difficulty of these problems. So let R q to the n be the standard Borel space of all subgroups of q to the n of rank exactly n, and let isomorphism sub n denote the isomorphism relation on this class of groups. Notice that if I've got two rank n groups which are isomorphic, then the isomorphism initially is a Z-linear map, but because they're torsion-free, the map must actually be Q-linear, which tells me that there's an invertible matrix which sends one group to the other. So the isomorphism relation is simply the orbit equivalence relation of the general linear group over the rationals on this space of groups. So in particular, this is a countable Borel equivalence relation. So it fits into this this general context. So this was pointed out by Horth and Kekris in a paper, I think the mid-90s. In this paper, they also made rather a bold conjecture, which would have excused the failure of all these people. They said the reason why Maltsev and Kurosh, etc., had failed to classify the rank 2 groups was that the rank 2 groups was already a universal countable Borel equivalence relation. Now, since this means it's bireducible for to the classification problem for arbitrary finitely generated groups, this would certainly have explained their failure, because nobody imagines that you can satisfactorily classify all finitely generated groups. A couple of years later, Horth, in a lovely paper, made the first progress in this problem. He showed that the rank 2 groups were generally harder than the rank 1 groups, in the sense that you can't Borel reduce the rank 2 problem to the rank 1 problem. Then a couple of years after that, building on work of Adams and Kekris, I showed that actually rank 2 is less difficult than rank 3, rank 4, etc. So you have a whole increasing hierarchy of difficulty. But then, in particular, the original conjecture that rank 2 was as hard as it gets is false. I mean, rank 3 is harder, rank 4 is harder, etc., etc., etc. Okay. One of the things that's sort of nice about this result is Adams and Kekris showed that there's a whole rich structure within the countable Borel equivalence relations. And it's nice to see at least some of that complexity showing up in a classical algebraic problem which people have studied before. I'm not going to contrast this with a situation with, say, RE degrees, because I think during the last 2 years I've already made enough enemies there by my unfortunate habit of referring to Church's thesis for real mathematics, which I mean explicit equals Borel, so we won't go into that. I should mention, although my name is there for proving it, it's one-third due to Horth, one-third due to Adams Kekris, and then finally one-third to me, and then another third or even more to Zimmer, because this is an application of Zimmer superrigidity. Okay, so this is generally taken to mean that the classification problem for finite rank groups is intractable. It would be a little more convincing had the Horth-Kekris conjecture been true, because it's actually not clear quite how difficult these are. For example, it's far from clear how difficult the rank two groups are. But for the moment, let's take it as saying that, yes, this shows that the classification problem for all finite rank groups is intractable. Then what should we do? Well, naturally, we should restrict our attention to a smaller class of groups. So today I'll be looking at what are called the p-local groups. So an abelian group is said to be p-local if it's divisible by every prime except for p. So the idea is you've concentrated all of the complexity into a single prime. And, okay, I'm going to let RPQ to the n be the standard Borel space of all p-local groups of rank n. And then isomorphism with an upper p will be the isomorphism relation on the rank p groups of rank, sorry, the p-local groups of rank n. Unfortunately, the first result along these lines is a bit discouraging, because just like with all rank n is less than rank n plus 1, etc., if you fix a prime, then you get the same sort of increasing hierarchy. The rank 1 p-locals are less than the rank 2 p-locals, etc., etc. And just as disappointing, the proof is essentially identical to that of Theorem 4. So you get nothing new out whatsoever. However, fortunately, this theorem answers a question which should never have been asked anyway. This is the wrong question. If you ask how are p-local groups used, if you have an arbitrary torsion-free abelian group, then for every single prime, you form what's called the p-localization. Namely, you put in the qth roots for every other prime. You then have this infinite sequence of groups. You study these, and whatever information you extract about those tells you something about your original group. Now, this strategy, of course, implicitly assumes that looking at p-local groups is easier than looking at arbitrary groups. So this seems a more natural question. Is it indeed the case that the p-local groups of a given rank are easier to understand than arbitrary p-local groups? So here's the real question. Fix a prime and some n, at least 2. Is the classification problem for the p-local torsion-free abelian groups of rank n strictly easier than that for arbitrary groups of the same rank? The key to this question turns out to be a related question of some interest in its own right. Again, fix your n and take 2 distinct primes. Are the classification problems for the p-local groups and the q-local groups of a given rank comparable with respect to Borel reducibility? So in other words, suppose there was a higher intelligence which understood the 5 local groups. Would this be of any help in trying to understand the 7 local groups? Okay. Oh, and of course, I should mention, if you have a negative answer to question 10, it implies a positive answer to question 9, because a negative answer to question 10, it would say that if you know the 5 locals, you know the 5 locals, you know no other prime. Whereas, of course, if you know any group of a given rank, you know every single prime. Okay, so So, last semester, I almost completely answered this question. So here are the results I'd like to discuss this afternoon. So, if n is at least 3, and we have two different primes, then the isomorphism problems for the p-local and q-local groups of a given rank are incomparable with respect to Borel reducibility. And so, of course, arbitrary n-rank groups know a lot more than p-local rank n groups. Again, this one of the nice features of this result is that we now have a naturally occurring antichain, infinite antichain, amongst the countable Borel equivalence relations. Oh, you notice I say if n is at least 3. The reason for that, those of you who are here this morning will be able to guess, I'm going to apply superrigidity, and superrigidity tends to start after n equals 2. So n equals 2 is a completely open problem, which seems related to trying to understand triable Borel equivalence relations. N equals 1 is a not very interesting problem because there are exactly 2 p-local groups of rank n for every p, and of course you can form a Borel bijection between 2 sets of size 2. So the first question is trivially yes, the second trivially yes for number 9, and trivially yes for number 10 in the case n equals 1. So n equals 1 is not worth thinking about. Okay, so for the rest of the talk, what I want to do is try to explain why theorem 11 is true, and in particular, I want to give an illustration of how to use superrigidity in studying problems in algebra and in Borel equivalence relations. So, let's start. So first let's note, this is quite a concrete question. I already mentioned that if we have 2 rank n groups, then they're isomorphic precisely if there is an n by n matrix with rational entries which sends one to the other. So again, we have a countable Borel equivalence relation, and all we have to do is show that, to show there's no Borel reduction, I'm just rewriting it, there isn't a Borel map from the space of p-locals to q-locals, such that 2 things lie in the same g-orbit in the first one, if and only if their images lie in the same general linear orbit in the other one. So it's an extremely concrete question. We have a very nice group, just the general linear group over the rationals. That could be better, but still we can live with that for the moment. And then unfortunately we have a truly disgusting space that it's acting upon. The question is not quite as concrete as it looks because the space of p-local groups is so complicated as to be completely unintelligible. So the first thing we want to do is to try to simplify the underlying space on which the group acts. Okay. Now, to do that, what we're going to do is apply a further localization. So this is something called the Kurash-Maltsev localization. I have no idea why it's called the Kurash-Maltsev localization, since it's clearly a completion, not a localization, but anyway, let's see. So for each of my p-local groups, I'm going to let a hat be, okay, zp denotes the p-adic integers, and then there's that tensor product a. The tensor product is, if you haven't done your passed your qualifying exams too recently, you've probably forgotten what the tensor product is. So I'll say what this actually means. Our original group is a subgroup of an n-dimensional space over the rationals. I'm now going to regard it as a subgroup of a bigger vector space. So instead of the rationals, I look at the p-adic field, and I look at the n-dimensional space over this. Then A tensor ZP is simply the ZP linear combinations of elements of A. Okay, so I just generate a bigger group. Now, why on earth, you may wonder, should I want to do something like that? Well, the point is, A itself could have an extremely complicated arithmetic structure. However, if I tensor with the p-adic integers, I get something which has an extremely simple structure. You see, it breaks up into a vector subspace together with a free module over the p-adic integers. Okay. Now, what I want to do then is, with each of my groups, I'm going to look at the associated vector subspace. Now, if I have two of my p-local groups, if they're isomorphic, there is a linear transformation sending one group to the other. Now, I can regard that linear transformation as taking place not in the vector space over the rationals, but rather over the p-adics. In that case, it must be that as A goes to B, A hat goes to B hat. And under this mapping, the corresponding vector space part of A hat goes to the vector space part of B hat, because those are the maximal divisible subgroups. So what I'd like to do is, instead of looking at my group acting on the p-local groups, I'd like to look at the group acting on the associated vector spaces, because this is just subspaces of a vector space, which to me feels like a pretty concrete object. When I pointed out this is supposedly my tactic in a talk at Rutgers, Greg Chirling pointed out that it's a little implausible, because if you take a typical group A, then its intersection with VA is the identity element. Now, fortunately, Greg is right when he points this out. Fortunately, I didn't notice it when I was thinking about this problem. So if you don't notice it, you find that it's actually a good move to make. So why is it a good move? What does VA remember? Okay, so I have to introduce, Theorem 17 will say exactly what it does remember, but first we need some notation. A is said to be quasi-equal to B, or we might say commensurable, if the intersection has finite index in both A and B. Now, if we restrict our attention to torsion-free abelian groups of finite rank, this turns out to be, once again, a countable Borel equivalence relation. Okay. A is said to be quasi-isomorphic, or virtually isomorphic, if you can find a linear transformation such that phi of A is quasi-equal to B. So they're isomorphic up to a finite error on the top. Okay, so here's the result which tells us exactly what V of A remembers. Two p-local groups are quasi-equal if and only if the associated vector spaces are actually equal. It says in particular that this quasi-equality relation is smooth, because I can attach an element of a standard Borel space which completely characterizes when you're quasi-equal. Then again, quasi-isomorphism, it simply says there is a linear transformation which maps the associated vector space to the associated vector space. So the vector space VA remembers virtually everything about the group. It remembers the group up to a finite error on the top. Yeah? Oh, no. For generic A, VA intersect A is trivial. And so that's why it seems at first surprising it should remember something. But then the point is, you then complete it with sort of a lattice to the side of it, and it says that the whole thing must contain, well, if you take a lattice from right across the whole thing, any two lattices are commensurable, so that it remembers a lot more than apparently it does. Okay, so let's see. So, to summarize, what we've now seen is, if I look at the isomorphism relation on the class of p local groups, then it's literally virtually the same as the orbit equivalence relation on the collection of vector subspaces of an n-dimensional space over the p-adics. Unfortunately, virtually the same isn't good enough. Particularly in this case, there's still some details to check, but I've more or less convinced myself that if I look at the isomorphism relation and the quasi-isomorphism relation on this class of groups, they're actually incomparable with respect to Borel reducibility, which says that I can't directly look at this nicer action. Unless I, of course, change the question. But Saharan has repeatedly pointed out that redefining the target after you've shot is cheating. So we'll stick with the original problem. In this case, as I said, if you start off with isomorphism, and then you weaken it to this broader class of quasi-isomorphism, it turns out you get things which are incomparable. If instead you were to work with arbitrary finitely generated groups and do the corresponding thing, where you're allowed to, you identify two finitely generated groups if, well, maybe they have subgroups of finite index, or you factor away finite normal subgroups, then it turns out that, which you might call virtual isomorphism, that's strictly harder than isomorphism for finitely generated groups. And it even takes us to a place that Greg Horth has referred to as the dark side. This is an example of a Borel equivalence relation which isn't reducible to the orbit equivalence relation of the action of any Polish group. Okay, but anyway, getting back to our thing. We've seen that virtual isomorphism gives us a very nice action to consider. It turns out there is one place where virtual isomorphism and isomorphism coincide. So for each K, let V upper K be the standard space of exactly K-dimensional subspaces. Now, if I have a p-local group and its associated vector space has dimension n minus 1, so as large as you can get without being the whole space, then anything else which is virtually isomorphic to it is actually isomorphic. The reason for this is that if your vector subspace has the maximal dimension, then, because these are p-local, every subgroup of finite index must have prime power index. And this statement that the associated subspace has maximal dimension, it says that if I look at PA, this is A is my group, PA is a certain subgroup of finite index, it actually has index P. So that if I look at the subgroups of finite index in my group, they form a straight line. PA, PA, P squared A, P cubed A. So to be commensurable, the isomorphism is given by simply multiplying by a suitable power of the prime P. Commensurability comes in a straight line, so it's trivial in this particular case. Now, as well as that, there's also a map. If I look at the vector subspaces of dimension n minus 1, there is a Borel map, the collection of p-local groups, which to each subspace associates a group which has precisely that subspace as its associated subspace. So what this is saying, these two results together, is that provided I fix my attention on those subgroups whose associated subspace has dimension n minus 1, it is exactly the same as looking at the action of the general linear group on the n minus one dimensional subspaces of this vector space over the p-adics. Okay, so let's summarize all that and how far we've got. So, let's finally suppose we've got a Borel reduction and begin towards our contradiction. So, suppose I've got a Borel reduction from the p-locals to the q-locals. So two p-locals are isomorphic if and only if their images are isomorphic in the q-locals. And let's consider a composite Borel map. So any n minus one dimensional space, I first send it to a group which is associated with it. I then send that group across to a q-local via my Borel reduction, and then I pass to the associated subspace. Now, the first two arrows send equivalent things to equivalent things in an if and only if fashion. The final one, there's a certain collapse, but only countably many isomorphism types get sent to any particular quasi-isomorphism class. So we have a countable to one map with that final arrow. So what this is telling us altogether is we have a Borel map which is countable to one and maps general linear Q orbits to general linear Q orbits. So we now have an extremely concrete group acting on extremely concrete spaces. We're getting into really good shape as far as an application of superrigidity goes. So let's see. Okay. Now comes the point where we admit this group, while it's reasonably concrete, it's really not what we want. Because if you remember from this morning, superrigidity applies to lattices, not to arbitrary countable linear groups. So the next thing we want to do is to set ourselves up properly by, instead of looking at the action of the general linear group on this collection of n minus one dimensional spaces, I'm going to restrict my attention to the action of the special linear group with integer coefficients. Okay, so. Right, so this needs some explanation. So now I'm looking at the n by n matrices, determinant one, with integer coefficients acting on the usual space. And you notice that now there's a measure has appeared, this mu p, which I'm calling the p-adic probability measure. Okay, where does this come from? Well, if I look at the special linear group over the p-adic integers, it's an easy exercise to show that this actually acts transitively on the collection of n minus one dimensional subspaces over the q-adic field. Now, SLNZP is a compact group, which tells us that if we look at its Ha measure, that can be taken to be a probability measure. Now, given that this group with a compact with a Ha probability measure acts transitively on the set, it transfers its probability measure onto that set. So mu p is that transferred natural probability measure coming from the transitive action of this compact group SLNZP. Okay, now that probability measure is actually the unique probability measure which is preserved by SLNZP. Okay, now if I look at SLNZ, I've been claiming up here, consider the ergodic action of SLNZ. Why is it ergodic? Well, basically because SLNZ is a dense subgroup of SLNZP. So any probability measure that it preserved would be preserved by the larger group, which only preserves one probability measure. Consequently, SLNZ also only preserves one probability measure. So this action is ergodic. Okay. And now this allows us to even make the picture simpler. Because the action is ergodic, every time I apply F, I end up in one of finitely many spaces, the L-dimensional spaces for some L, under under the appropriate word, on a measure one subset, we're going to end up in the same dimension. So now things have got really nice. We've got a countable to one map, which maps SLNZ orbits to general linear group orbits. We've got an ergodic measure around. Things couldn't be better. This feels just like the sort of situation for applying Zimmer superrigidity. Of course, very few people in the audience know what it means to apply Zimmer superrigidity. So what do? At this point, we think to ourselves, okay, what is going to be the punchline? What Zimmer, at the moment, we've got a map which simply sends orbits to orbits, but completely ignores the structure of the group action, etc. At this point, you say to yourself, okay, what's the simplest possible case that this could be describing? And can I solve that? And then with luck, Zimmer superagility will simply take you to the most simple-minded special case, and you'll be done. So at this point, once you figure out we can apply Zimmer superagility because we're looking at classical groups acting in a fairly classical space, the question is, what is the punchline? So here's what is supposed to be the punchline. So what's the simplest way this could occur? Well, the easiest thing that could happen is when I'm looking at my F here, what it should do is not just send orbits to orbits, it should also, for a start, I don't like having the general linear group over here, so instead I'll put the special linear group over the integers. Okay, so it should send SLN Z orbits to SLN Z orbits. That's still too complicated because if you just send orbits to orbits, you don't see anything. So let's suppose even more. Let's suppose that it respects absolutely everything it could. Let's suppose that it's an isomorphism of permutation groups. So what this would mean is, okay, I'm allowed to throw away measure zero subsets of both. Then I've got to have a Borel bijection between those measure one subsets that are left, which preserves the measure. There should also be an isomorphism from SLNZ to SLNZ such that the group actions are also preserved. So that if this point gets sent to this point, I go across here, the corresponding group element should send the corresponding point to the point. So it's everything is preserved. Okay, this is, with luck, this is where Zimmer superagility will take us. So that being the case, can we prove that these are non-isomorphic? This is supposed to be the punchline. What this says is, look at the group acting on this collection of subspaces with this p-adic measure. Can we spot the prime? Now, you can't spot the prime by simply looking at an orbit, because on a measure one subset, the group acts freely, so that all you see is the Cayley graph of this group. Okay, I've slightly oversimplified things here. It doesn't quite act freely. If n is odd, then you'd have to factor out by plus minus the identity matrix. But I don't want to complicate the notation more than I have to, so you can either silently put in a p whenever you see an s, or else you could decide that from now on, n is an odd number, and you don't have to do that, and then we just stick with matrices. Okay, so looking at an orbit tells you nothing. So how are we to spot the prime? The way we're going to do it is we're going to count the number of ergodic components of subgroups of finite index. Okay, what does this mean? Well, our group SLNZ is acting ergodically, meaning that the only invariant Borel subsets have size or measure 0 or 1. If I pass to a subgroup of finite index, there is no reason why this should remain true. But what will happen is the space will break up into a disjoint union of finitely many positive measure sets on which the group acts ergodically. And this decomposition will be unique up to measure zero subsets. So what I want to do is look at smaller and smaller subgroups of finite index inside my group and count how many ergodic components are there? Okay. So, let's suppose that delta is a normal subgroup of finite index in SLNZ, and let's let the closure of delta be the closure of, delta in the corresponding group over the p-adic integers. Okay, now the index of the closure inside the group over the p-adic integers, that's going to be a bounded number b times a certain power of the prime p. Why is that? Well, that b is, it's the divisor of SLN over the field with p elements. The point here is there's a natural homomorphism of SLNZP onto SLNFP, and if I look at its kernel, it's what's called a pro-P group, meaning that every closed subgroup of finite index has prime power index. So as I start looking at closed subgroups of finite index in SLN over the p-adics, what I'm going to always get is a bounded number and larger powers of my prime as I go further down through suitable normal subgroups. Okay, now then, what are the ergodic components for the action of delta on my space? Well, it turns out that they're simply the orbits of the closure of delta on my space. And why is that? Well, essentially because delta is dense in its closure. So the same sort of argument that we gave before for why SLN is acting ergodically on the whole space. This comes in. Okay, but now there's something else which is good, which is why I chose it to be a normal subgroup. Now, SLNZP actually acts transitively on the collection of its closure delta orbits. Why? The closure of delta is a normal subgroup of the larger group, and it's well known that if a group acts transitively and you take a normal subgroup, it permutes the orbits of that normal subgroup. Okay, so if I want to know how many orbits, in other words, how many ergodic components, well, my group acts transitively, so the number is the index of the stabilizer of one of them in the whole group. Now, the stabilizer is going to lie somewhere between the closure, which certainly preserves its own orbits, and the whole group. So the stabilizer will be a divisor of B P to the R, namely C P to the S. And by choosing suitable congruent subgroups, I can make this number as big as I like. So eventually, I've got a teeny number times a huge power of P, a teeny number times a huge power of Q. They are different. Okay, so these things are very much non-isomorphic simply by looking at the number of ergodic components as we look at suitable normal subgroups of finite index. Okay, I said robust because I've actually shown a lot more than I just said. So I'll say what I've shown because I'll need rather more at the end. Okay. So what did we actually show? So the argument, it doesn't just show they're not isomorphic, it says they're not virtually isomorphic, where this means we're allowed to first pass to subgroups of finite index and then restrict our attention to ergodic components, because exactly the same argument goes through to show that this power, this prime, shows up very, very strongly. And then a technical thing, more generally, this argument is going to show you that neither is a virtual factor of the other, where you don't make it necessarily an isomorphism, but a surjective homomorphism. And then there's something very technical, which is there basically so I can keep a clean conscience. This is also true if I pass to what's called a finite ergodic extension, which means that you replace every point by finitely many points. And that's only there because one of the standard moves in superrigidity theory is every so often you want to pass to a suitable subgroup of finite index, and the cost you pay is to pass to a finite ergodic extension. So this is just one of the standard moves of the subject. So I'll ignore that for the rest of the talk, but I feel better anyway. Okay. So we got a really good punchline. See if we can connect the start of the proof to the punchline. So let's see, where were we? So, what we had was a Borel map which was countable to one, and it mapped SLNZ orbits to general linear Q orbits. And the general linear Q is a real nuisance because basically we can only work with lattices. However, another standard move of the subject, we can suppose things aren't quite as bad as the whole of the general linear group over the rationals. We can suppose that we're sending SLNZ orbits to SLNZ, where now I allow in fractions with finitely many primes underneath. Okay. Now this, unfortunately, that's still not a lattice. It's a dense subgroup, but let's call it lambda. This lambda is a lattice in a rather more complicated group, a certain product group. So SLNR times a certain product of SLNs over various quiotic fields. And, okay, let me just... no, nothing is supposed to be trivial. When I say standard moves, standard moves is shorthand for the various tricks which Adams and Kekris have shown of how to use Zimmer superagility in the Borel context. So this, here I'm using the fact that I'm working with a Kajdan group and, yeah. But while I only wrote without loss of generality, I did say a standard move, okay? So most of my proofs will be a standard move, and it usually be, it'll mean that there's a lot behind it. Oh, okay. But, well, the trouble is, you see, I learned everything that I know in that paper of you and Alekos. So, okay. One more thing. There's a certain subgroup K which will play an important role in, well, the last couple of minutes of this talk. Within the special linear group over these various quiotic fields, we've got the product of the special linear groups over the corresponding quiotic integers. This group has various nice properties. Well, first of all, it's compact, being a product of compact groups. Secondly, it's actually an open subgroup of this product. And what that tells us is, if I take an arbitrary compact subgroup, it's going to have a subgroup of finite index contained in K. So for all practical purposes, I can imagine that K is my maximal compact subgroup of this corresponding product. So whenever I see a compact group, I can suppose it lies inside of K. Another thing which is worth pointing out is that K has countable index in this product of the full quiotic groups. And so inside of H, I've got my K, and I've also got the special linear group over the reals, this corresponding first coordinate group. Okay. Now then, so what can superrigidity get you in these sorts of situations? At the moment, we have maps which simply send orbits to orbits. What I really want is a map which doesn't just send orbits to orbits, but respects the group operation. What superrigidity tends to do is it allows you to have to slightly perturb your map, so what you get is more or less an isomorphism of permutation groups, but it comes at a cost. This more or less is, instead of being an isomorphism, you end up with an embedding of permutation groups. So I'll just say something about that here. I've got SL and it's going somewhere into my space Y. Okay. Zimmer superrigidity plus standard moves, which means now, as well as the paper of Alekos and Scott, a paper of Scott by himself, the one in the Heinel proceedings. If I take Y, what I'm going to do is I'm going to take Y and induce it up to a space on which my larger group H acts. So I take Y times H over gamma. What this literally means is, you take a set of coset representatives, a Borel set of coset representatives, then H can act on lots of copies of Y indexed by the coset representatives. If I take an element of H, it doesn't quite send a coset representative to a coset representative. What's left over is an element of gamma, and I let that act on the corresponding copy of my space. So I got lots of copies of my original space indexed by this quotient space. Now, if I was extremely lucky and none of these SLN Qs were here, then it would be literally true that, assuming no degeneracy, I would end up with a permutation group embedding of this space into this much larger space. So I've paid a certain price for going from a just orbits to orbits map to a permutation group embedding. The space has got much larger. Okay. Now, unfortunately, this isn't true when I've got all of these things here. What we do have, though, is something which is almost as good. And here I'm afraid I'm going to start actually lying. So, slightly oversimplifying, if I try to do this argument of embedding my group inside a larger permutation group, in my first coordinate, I more or less get a group homomorphism. But then I get error terms appearing. But error terms which appear inside a compact subgroup. Now, as far as we're concerned, there's only one compact subgroup in the world. So what I do is I take my space and I factor out by that compact subgroup. At this point, I more or less have a permutation group embedding of SLNZ over my original space into SLNR over Y, indexed not by the original induced one, but factored out by the compact subgroup. In case any of you are looking closely at this, I'll point out where the lie comes in, which is that if I'm looking at my induced space, it's of course the diagonal action is the action that's going on my space, whereas here I'm confusing it with the action in the first coordinate. So the expert should please ignore this slight error so that I can continue the rest of the argument to give a flavor of the sort of arguments you put in to reach the punchline. Okay, so let's suppose, slightly oversimplifying, with the emphasis on oversimplifying, what Zimmer superrigidity does for you in this context is it takes you from just orbit to orbit maps to a map on the level of permutation groups, which you've paid a big price. You've now gone into a much larger space. Now, what we would like is that if I look at the image of X under my adjusted map, it should lie in one of the copies of Y that's being permuted around. If it lay in just one of the copies of Y, then we would be in the situation of our robust punchline. Namely, when you follow through the definition, you'd see that I would end up with an actual isomorphism of permutation groups, a measure-preserving isomorphism. It would even be good enough if we could show that our X ended up in finitely many copies, at least up to measure zero. The thing that worries us is it might be spread all over the space. So what we have to do is study the distribution of the image of X in this very large space. Okay, now then there's one simplification we can make right at the start. There's only countably many SLNR orbits on the index set. Why is that? Well, that's because K has countable index in this part of the index set, which means that K together with SLNR has countable index in the whole of H. Okay, so because we're acting ergodically, then again I can assume that I'm ending up in a single SLNR orbit. Okay, and now we're getting in good shape because we're getting to the point where we can begin to apply Ratner's measure classification theorem. Okay, so right, so we have that f of x is going to end up in the copies of our space indexed by a single SLN r orbit. Furthermore, you can define a natural, well, phi SLN z. So this is under the embedding of SLN z in SLN r, invariant ergodic probability measure on our index set omega by the probability of a set, a subset of the index set, is the probability that someone in our original space ends up in one of those copies. Okay, and so this is invariant under the action of the lattice phi SLN z, and furthermore, omega together with little omega is a factor, a homomorphic image of our original space. So what we have then is a homogeneous space for SLNR with an ergodic probability measure invariant under the action of a certain lattice. Now, this is exactly the situation which was studied by Ratner and further people. Oh, I should mention, the next paragraph is shamelessly stolen from a paper of Scott Adams. There are also ingredients in it independently due to Dave Witter and Alex Furman. Okay, so none of this is due to me. This is, again, these I would regard now as standard moves. Standard moves are parts of other people's papers that you can steal, yeah? Okay. So, Ratner's measure classification theorem says that there are essentially only two possibilities for this invariant measure. Either this invariant measure is not just invariant under the action of the lattice, but as the whole of SLNR, in which case it is the Haar measure, that would correspond to spreading your points uniformly all the way through this. The other possibility is that the measure has finite support, and that would correspond to these points lying in finitely many copies of Y, which is what we want. Okay, now then, fortunately, at this point, you begin to think there's a conspiracy. Everything that could possibly go right is going right. So, at this point, thank goodness, the dynamical properties of our original space rule out the first possibility. What does that mean? Well, our first space, it essentially comes from the action of a dense subgroup in a compact group. And this fails to have what's called the strong mixing property. On the other hand, if you had Haar measure around, that would be strongly mixing. Alternatively, if you wanted to really impress your friends, you could say entropy. And then, okay, that also would rule this out. So what it's telling us is that there's a finite set which supports all the measure. Now, given that the measure is invariant under the action of phi SLNZ, it has to be that finite set is invariant under the action of the group. Consequently, there's a subgroup of finite index which fixes everything pointwise, and, well, we end up, this implies that these two things are virtually isomorphic and are robust. Punchline takes over, and we're done. Over here, I lied slightly. The lie costs me a factor of a finite ergodic extension. Okay, but this basically is it. Okay, to finish off, I should mention the case n equals 2 is completely open. The difficulty there is that you'd be dealing with sort of lattices in rank 1 groups, and superrigidity simply doesn't help you at that point. Conceivably, the techniques that Greg Horth found in the summer might be relevant. I hope so. So.